You know, if you look at a car, you immediately see the steel, right? The rubber, the
Just
glass.
the tangible parts.
Exactly. And if you look at a human brain, you see the neurons, the synapses, all that gray matter.
Yeah, the stuff you can physically point to.
Right. Because usually when we try to figure out how reality works, we instinctively just point to the stuff that is actually there. I mean, the matter, the atoms.
That's how we're wired, honestly.
Yeah. We have built our entire scientific worldview around this idea of presence.
Well, and it makes complete intuitive sense. I mean, we catalog the things we can touch, measure,
Yeah.
weigh,
Yeah.
that has basically been the dominant operating system of the physical sciences for centuries. You defined a system by just creating an inventory of its parts.
But then you encounter a concept that forces you to realize you might have been staring so hard at the puzzle pieces that you completely ignored the empty spaces, allowing them to actually fit
Oh,
together.
absolutely. It's a complete paradigm shift.
It really is. So today we are stepping into a conceptual landscape that kind of challenges the absolute bedrock of how we define existence, causality, and honestly, even the thoughts currently bouncing around inside our own heads.
It gets deep very quickly.
It does. We are doing a deep dive today, unpacking a profoundly fascinating 2026 paper by C.F. Dietz. It's titled The Grammar of Absence.
Such a great title.
It is, right? And the mission for our time together with you today is to explore how something that literally isn't there might actually be the primary key to understanding life, consciousness, and basically the entire cosmos.
I know it sounds, well, dangerously close to mysticism at first glance,
Oh, for sure.
like the idea that nothing could somehow do something.
Right, it sounds like magic.
Yeah, but the brilliance of Dietz's paper is how it grounds this in rigorous, unforgiving physical reality. There's no magic involved.
No, not at all. And to pull this off, Dietz brings together their own closure framework with an earlier, just massive intellectual force, which is Terence Deacon's 2011 concept of the absential.
Right, from his book, Incomplete Nature.
Yes, incomplete nature. And Dietz actually opens this new 2026 paper by directly quoting Deacon. And this specific quote just stopped me in my tracks when I first read it.
It's a powerful one.
It really is. Deacon writes, "Longing, desire, passion, appetite, mourning, loss, aspiration, all are based on an analogous intrinsic incompleteness, an integral withoutness."
Yeah, that phrase, integral withoutness, it's doing a whole lot of heavy lifting there.
It really is.
It perfectly bridges the deeply subjective emotional human experience, mourning, longing, with this very structural physical geometry.
Right.
Keats is essentially arguing that this withoutness isn't just some poetic feeling we experience, it is the fundamental architecture of the mind itself.
I mean, to understand how a literal void actually creates a mind, we kind of have to strip away the emotion completely for a second.
Yes, yeah, start from the absolute basics.
Right. We have to look at a very simple, dead physical object just to see how nothing can actually exert force in the physical world.
And the source material grounds this entire paradigm in a deceptively simple thought experiment.
The wagon wheel.
Exactly, a classic wooden wagon wheel. Just picture it. You have a solid wooden hub right in the center, heavy wooden spokes radiating outward, and then an iron-banded rim tying the whole circumference together.
Right, totally standard.
But crucially, right at the absolute center of the hub, there is a hole for the axle.
And we really need to dwell on the literal physical reality of that hole for a minute.
We do, because the hole is definitively not a part of the wheel.
Right, it has literally no substance.
None. It has no mass, no atomic weight, zero density. It possesses absolutely none of the physical properties that the wood or the iron possess.
You cannot point to the hole in the same way you can, like, tap your knuckle against a wooden spoke.
Right. And the paper makes this brilliant observation about that. If you were to completely disassemble that wagon wheel,
Just take it all apart.
yeah, pull out every single spoke, detach the rim, and throw the whole thing into a pile of components on the floor.
You will not find the hole sitting there in the pile.
Exactly. It just isn't there. It is fundamentally nothing.
But here is the pivot that kind of breaks open standard physics. Despite being literally nothing, the whole is causally efficacious.
Right. It has real, undeniable causal power in the physical world.
Because think about it, if you were to fill that hole with solid wood, the wheel ceases to function.
It completely breaks the system.
It can no longer turn on an axle. It fundamentally stops being a wheel and just becomes, well, a heavy circular arrangement of wood blocking a wagon from moving.
Exactly. But wait, think about what a standard physicalist scientist does when they're analyzing that wheel.
Right, the traditional approach.
Yeah. If I hand a traditional physicist a wagon wheel, they will measure the density of the yoke. They'll check the tensile strength of the iron band, calculate the exact geometrical angles of the spokes.
We'll give you a massive spreadsheet.
They will create a 100% complete, flawless ledger of every single atom present in that object.
Okay, let's unpack this, though, because I can hear the pushback. If a physicist has a 100% complete ledger of the atoms, aren't they fully describing the object?
It seems like they are.
Right. Like, are you telling me their math is fundamentally wrong just because they didn't measure empty air?
Well, their math isn't wrong at all, but their causal explanation is entirely incomplete.
Ah, okay.
And this is the exact critique Deakin leveled at Standard Science, which Dietz is building on. If you only describe the wood and the metal, you have systematically omitted the constitutive role of the absence.
The causal power of the wheel, its ability to actually channel kinetic energy to rotate, to move a wagon forward?
It lies equally in what is not there. The physicist's ledger is completely full of facts, but it is effectively blind to function.
Wow, blind to function. Because the whole is what Deakin calls a structured absence, right?
Exactly.
It's not just random empty space. Like, empty space is everywhere. It's trivial.
Right. It's not just the vacuum of space.
Yeah. This is a highly specific, bounded absence. The entire presence of the wood and the iron spokes is organized around that void.
Yes. The absence is literally dictating the arrangement of the physical matter.
Which means you cannot account for the system's behavior without accounting for that structured absence at its core.
It is just as real, functionally and causally, as the heavy iron rim itself.
And Deakin actually coined a specific term for this broader category of things, right?
Yeah, he calls them absential phenomena.
Absential phenomena. So these are things whose very existence is defined by something being missing, separate, or just unrealized.
Right. And the text points out that once you accept this category, once you see it, you realize they completely dominate biology and the mind.
They are just everywhere. Let's look at some examples from the text, like the concept of a biological function.
Oh, that's a perfect one. Think about a heart.
Right. If you have a heart, its clear function is to pump blood.
But pumping blood tomorrow, or even pumping blood a second from now, isn't a physical object present in the heart tissue today.
Wow, yeah.
The function of the organ is defined entirely by a future state, a completely unrealized outcome.
So the function is quite literally tethered to an absence.
Exactly. Or, you know, consider an evolutionary adaptation.
Okay.
Like a polar bear. It has incredibly thick, highly specialized fur.
Right, to survive the Arctic.
Right. That fur is an adaptation to extreme, lethal cold. But the adaptation itself is defined by a relationship to an environmental challenge that might not even be present at a given moment.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, if you transport a polar bear to a zoo in Florida, its fur is still structurally an adaptation to the Arctic cold, even though the cold is entirely absent from its current reality.
The physical matter of the fur is essentially shaped by the ghost of the freezing temperature.
That's a great way to put it, the ghost of the temperature.
And this scales right up to our own internal experience, doesn't it? I mean, think about a single thought. A thought is defined by what it is about. Like, if I am sitting here right now thinking about the Eiffel Tower, well, the Eiffel Tower is definitively not inside my skull.
Hopefully not.
Right. The neurons firing in my brain, the electrical impulses, the chemical neurotransmitters, those are all physical presences.
You can measure all of those.
Yeah, I can put you in an MRI and measure them. But the thought itself, the actual aboutness of the thought, is defined by its relationship to a massive metal structure thousands of miles away.
The physical substrate is entirely present, but the meaning relies entirely on an absence.
And then you have purpose.
Right. Purpose.
A purpose is defined by a goal. By definition, when a purpose arises and actually drives your behavior, the goal has not yet been achieved.
Right. The goal is literally absent.
If the goal were physically present and realized, the purpose would just vanish.
Exactly. So functions, adaptations, thoughts, purposes. None of these can be fully characterized by a physicist just listing the physical structures present within them.
You literally cannot explain what they are without pointing to what they are not.
And I think we need to address this. There is a massive logical gap here that we have to cross.
Yeah, it's a big leap.
It is one thing to say that a thoughts about once relies on absence. Sounds, you know, a bit philosophical, a bit abstract.
Right. Like, how does nothing actually move atoms around?
That is the core question.
If I have a purpose, right, an active goal to go to the fridge and get an apple, that absent apple is somehow triggering electrical signals in my motor cortex.
Right.
It's causing muscle fibers in my legs to contract, and it is physically hauling my very heavy body across the room. How does a structured absence exert actual physical momentum?
And this is exactly where Deakin introduces his formal thermodynamic concept of constraint.
Constraint.
Yes. And Dietz leans incredibly heavily on this throughout the paper. In this framework, a constraint is not a force.
Okay, so it's not pushing something.
Right. It is not a physical hand pushing a system in a certain direction. A constraint is defined negatively, purely by exclusion.
It reduces the number of possible states a system can occupy.
Exactly.
The text actually uses the internal combustion engine to illustrate this, and I feel like it clarifies everything perfectly.
It's the best analogy for this.
Right. So think about the heavy metal cylinder inside a car engine. The cylinder's entire job is to constrain the motion of the piston.
But look really closely at how it actually achieves that.
Okay.
The cylinder wall does not add a single joule of energy to the system.
It doesn't push the piston down itself.
No, not at all. The chemical explosion of the vaporized fuel provides 100% of the actual energy. What the solid cylinder does is mathematically exclude all the spatial directions the piston cannot move.
Because if that solid cylinder wall wasn't there, the chemical energy of the combustion would just be this spherical, totally useless explosion of heat and noise.
Right. The energy would just dissipate in all directions instantly.
It would be pure entropy.
Yes. Cure entropy.
Well,
but because the constraint is there, because it closes off possibilities, it channels that raw chaotic energy into one single, highly specific, useful direction.
So the constraint actually does physical work precisely by not letting the energy go wherever it wants.
It exerts control entirely via exclusion.
So the cylinder wall is doing physical work by being a boundary of exclusion. The structured absence inside that cylinder is literally what allows the engine to drive the whole car forward.
And Deakin argues that this mechanism of constraint, this control via exclusion, is the exact physical mechanism of organization at every single level of reality.
Including biology.
Oh, especially biology. Take a strand of DNA.
Okay.
We constantly use this deeply flawed metaphor that a gene instructs a cell, right? Like it's a computer program giving affirmative commands.
Right, like it's saying build this, build that.
Yeah, but physically, chemically, that is not what is happening at all. A gene does not push molecules around.
A gene essentially acts as a constraint.
Yes. Think about the nearly infinite chaotic space of possible protein configurations that could theoretically form in the chemical soup of a cell.
It's mathematically staggering.
It really is. Out of all that chaos, the gene acts as a physical constraint, closing off the wrong options.
It excludes the vast majority of possibilities.
Exactly, leaving open only the highly specific protein shapes the cell actually needs to survive.
And that scales all the way up to cognition, doesn't it? I mean, a concept in your mind works the exact same way.
It really does.
When you walk into a room and you see a chair, your concept of chair doesn't magically generate a perfect image in your head.
No, because your visual cortex is just being flooded with a massive, totally chaotic barrage of photons.
Right. So your concept acts as a constraint.
That's
it excludes millions of incorrect interpretations of that sensory data.
So you don't perceive the chair as a pile of firewood.
Or a strange animal.
Or just a completely meaningless arrangement of colors.
Yeah. The concept is a cognitive boundary. It shapes the raw energy of your perception by actively excluding the noise.
It's exact.
Okay, so constraints are physically real. They do tangible work in the universe. I get that.
Yeah.
And they do it by exclusion, by being an absence of options. I completely buy that. But a metal cylinder in a car engine is a static, dead object.
It is.
And a living, breathing, thinking human being is something entirely different.
Very different.
So how do you stack these absences? Like, how do you actually build a living mind from dead matter just by layering constraints?
That is the crucial threshold, isn't it? How does matter organize itself into a mind?
Right.
Well, the source text outlines Deakin's exact thermodynamic map for this process. He describes three nested levels of thermodynamic organization.
Three steps to go from dead matter to a living, goal-oriented being.
Basically, yeah.
Let's spend some time in each of these levels because the architecture he lays out here is just stunning.
It really is elegant.
So level one is what Deakin calls homeodynamic.
Right. These are systems near equilibrium.
Homeodynamic. So to visualize this, imagine releasing a highly pressurized canister of gas into a sealed room, right?
Or dropping a single droplet of blue ink into a perfectly still glass of water.
Oh, that's a great visual. The ink just dissolves.
It just spreads out spontaneously.
Until the water is a perfectly even, uniform light blue.
Right. It is dead matter, essentially surrendering to entropy.
They move spontaneously toward maximum entropy. The second law of thermodynamics governs them, absolutely.
Exactly. They just spread out until everything is perfectly distributed, which essentially means no further work can be done.
There is zero persistent organization.
It's high chaos, low constraint, just atoms bumping into atoms until they settle into thermodynamic death.
But then we move up a step to the second level, which he calls morphodynamic.
Right, morphodynamic. These are systems that are pushed far from equilibrium.
Okay.
They actually maintain highly organized physical patterns. But, this is key, they require a continuous, relentless flow of external energy to do it.
The classic examples here are things like convection cells in boiling water.
Right, yeah, or whirlpools forming in a fast-moving river. Or even the flame of a candle.
Let's look at the whirlpool, because I think it makes it really clear. A whirlpool isn't just a random splashing of water.
No, it has a beautiful, mathematically clear, highly organized structure.
It's a persistent pattern, and that physical pattern acts as a constraint, channeling the chaotic water molecules into a highly specific spiral.
Which in turn physically reinforces the shape of the whirlpool itself.
So it is self-reinforcing organization. The form sustains the form.
Right. But, and the paper really highlights this as the critical limitation of this level, its organization is entirely fragile and externally dependent.
Oh, completely. If the river dries up, the whirlpool doesn't fight back.
Not at all.
It doesn't, like, crawl onto land looking for a puddle to survive in.
It just dissolves instantly back into a homeodynamic puddle.
It has absolutely no self-preservation. It is a wonderfully organized structure, but it is completely blind. It is not alive.
Which brings us to the holy grail of biology, right?
The third level.
Yes. Teleodynamic systems.
Teleodynamic. Yeah. So that's from the Greek telos, meaning end, purpose, or goal, right?
Exactly. This is where life actually begins.
Okay.
A teleodynamic system actively works to preserve its own organization against that constant drag of thermodynamic degradation.
So a living single-celled organism is the baseline example here.
The absolute baseline, yes. It doesn't just sit there letting energy passively pass through it like a whirlpool does.
Right.
It actively hunts. It captures energy from its environment. It synthesizes that energy to repair its own internal cellular boundaries. And it literally physically reproduces its own organization across time.
And this is the exact moment where genuine absential causation takes the wheel, isn't it?
It is.
Because think about what that single cell is actually doing. Its behavior is entirely constituted by what it is organized toward.
Yes. If the cell is running out of a specific glucose molecule, it will physically alter its behavior.
It will move its flagella.
It will change its chemical gradients, all to acquire that specific nutrient.
But the glucose is currently absent from the cell.
Exactly. But the absence of that glucose is exactly what is causing the cell's current frantic physical behavior.
The system is driven by a structured incompleteness. It is completely animated by what it lacks.
And that is a staggering takeaway when you really absorb it.
It really is. What Deakin mapped out here is that life, and eventually the mind itself, didn't emerge because the universe suddenly reached a certain temperature and sprinkled, like, magical life particles or consciousness dust onto some carbon atoms.
Right. There is no biological fairy dust.
None. Life emerged by organizing matter into deeply nested constraints.
Basically, a teleodynamic system is essentially a system of morphodynamic processes constraining each other.
Right. And in that nested system, the absent factors become the primary causal drivers of the whole organism.
The missing nutrients, the future state of survival, the goal, the lack literally becomes the engine.
It is a completely rigorously physicalist account of reality.
It is.
But it violently expands our definition of physics to include the causal thermodynamic power of what literally isn't there.
Which is just a brilliant framework.
Okay, so Deakin gives us this flawless thermodynamic ladder in 2011.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. It makes perfect sense of biology without invoking magic.
Right.
So why does CF Dietz need to write a massive new paper in 2026?
That's the big question.
Like, what was actually left unsolved? Why introduce this completely new closure framework if Deakin already mapped the territory so well?
Well, it comes down to a deeply specific philosophical gap.
Okay.
Dietz totally acknowledges that Deakin proved empirically that absential causation exists in nature.
Right. We can put a living cell under a microscope and watch it hunt for missing glucose.
Exactly. And Deakin proved it thermodynamically. He showed the math and the physics of how a whirlpool structurally differs from a living cell. But according to Dietz, Deakin didn't logically prove why any finite organized system must generate these absential features as a strict mathematical necessity.
Oh, I see.
Deakin showed that it does happen in the specific physical laws of our universe. But he basically left open a tiny philosophical loophole.
What's the loophole?
The possibility that this is all just a contingent, accidental quirk of our specific reality.
Ah, like maybe in some alternate universe with totally different rules of physics, you could have organized life that doesn't rely on absential causation at all.
Precisely. Dietz wants to completely slam that door shut.
Right.
Dietz wants to prove that absential causation is a logical, structural necessity.
It has to happen.
Yes, it has to happen, regardless of the specific thermodynamic laws in any conceivable universe where finite systems exist.
Okay, that is a huge claim.
It is. And to prove this, Dietz introduces the CCC framework.
Consciousness, closure, and the cosmos.
Exactly.
Let's lay out the architecture of Dietz's closure framework then.
Okay.
It relies on two main concepts that honestly are going to sound a bit abstract at first, but I promise they are going to snap everything we've talked about so far into intense focus.
They really tie it all together. All
right. So we need to define the closure regime and the remainder.
Let's start with the closure regime.
Okay.
In Dietz's vocabulary, a closure regime is basically any system that stabilizes its own content by drawing distinctions and establishing identity criteria.
Okay.
Essentially, it dictates what counts as a fact within its own operational scope.
Let's use an analogy to ground this because it helps a lot. Think about a digital camera.
Perfect.
The digital sensor inside that camera is a closure regime. It has a physical grid, and it establishes very strict criteria for reality.
Right.
It dictates that only photons of visible light, you know, red, green, and blue, count as facts, which it then records as pixels.
It draws a rigid, mathematically precise boundary around what it actually acknowledges as reality.
Right. But, and this is the kicker, whenever you draw a boundary and say, this is what matters, this is what is real to me, you inherently and inescapably create something else.
Yes. You create the remainder.
The remainder.
The remainder is the aspect of the inexhaustible world that the closure regime's specific distinctions cannot capture, model, or process.
It falls outside the net.
Right. It is generated exactly at the boundary of the closure.
So going back to the camera analogy.
Okay.
The sun is blasting that camera lens with visible light, but it is also blasting it with ultraviolet light and infrared radiation.
Tons of it.
The ultraviolet light is physically hitting the lens. It is real.
Very real.
But the camera's sensor, its closure regime, is structurally blind to it. It actively excludes it.
So the ultraviolet light becomes the remainder of that specific system.
Right. Now, here is where Dietz makes a massive philosophical claim, and it's actually a quote you flagged in the text earlier.
Oh, yes. Dietz writes, "The remainder is not noise. It is the proof that the grammar is finite."
I have to admit, I really struggled with this line at first.
It's dense.
I was pushing back against the text. Because if the camera actively ignores ultraviolet light, isn't the ultraviolet just irrelevant noise to the camera?
That's the intuitive way to think about it.
Yeah. Isn't it just static outside the signal? Why dignify it with this term remainder and call it proof of anything?
It is perhaps the most profound point in the entire framework. Honestly, it is definitively not noise.
Okay, explain why.
Think about the cosmos. Reality itself is essentially inexhaustible. It has infinite detail, infinite depth.
Right.
But any closure regime, whether it's a camera sensor, a single cell's metabolism, or even a human brain's predictive model, is finite.
It can't map the territory at a one-to-one scale. I mean, a map of the world that is exactly as detailed as the world is just the world.
Exactly. Because right. The world is inexhaustible and the system is finite, the system must leave something out.
It has no choice.
It is structurally obligated to fail to capture everything.
Mm.
And that specific boundary, the exact unique shape of how it fails, is what actually defines the system.
Oh, wow. So the remainder isn't just random static. The remainder is the exact specific shape of the system's own blindness.
Yes. And that brings us directly back to Deacon. The remainder is exactly the structured absence Deacon was talking about.
It's the hole in the wheel.
It is. It is physically real. It is present in the environment. But it is generated as an absence for the system by the system's own act of drawing a boundary.
And this is where the paper executes what it calls the grand translation.
This part is so satisfying.
It really is. Dietz basically takes Deacon's empirical thermodynamic terms and maps them flawlessly onto the structural philosophy of the closure framework.
It is exactly like discovering a Rosetta Stone that translates biology into pure logic.
Let's actually walk through these equivalences because they are incredibly precise.
Let's do it. The first equivalence is the foundational one. Deacon's essential equals Dietz's remainder.
Okay, so if we go all the way back to the very first example we talked about, the hole in the wagon wheel.
Right.
Deacon looks at that hole and calls it an essential feature. Dietz looks at it and calls it the remainder. It is the physical space that the rigid structure of the wooden wheel actively leaves out in order to function on the axle.
Right. It is the necessary exclusion.
Okay, that makes sense.
The second equivalence moves to causality. Deacon's constraints equal Dietz's closure boundaries.
Because both of these concepts are defined entirely by what they exclude.
Yes.
Let's test that against our engine analogy.
Perfect.
The solid metal wall of the cylinder is Deacon's constraint. It physically excludes the piston from moving sideways and blowing out the side of the engine.
Right.
In Dietz's philosophical terms, that cylinder wall is a closure boundary. It is drawing a physical distinction, determining what counts as directed, useful motion, which is inside the closure regime, it's part of the engine's function, and what gets violently rejected as waste heat, which then becomes the remainder.
They're describing the exact same physical boundary, just from two slightly different angles.
Wow.
And the third equivalence scales this up to the evolution of life itself. Deacon's three levels equal Dietz's nested closure regimes.
Let's map these out, too.
Sure.
Deacon's first level, the homeodynamic system, the gas dispersing in a sealed room. Dietz categorizes this as minimal closure.
Right.
It has a physical boundary, like the drywall of the room, but its remainder just dissipates into the walls as slight temperature changes. It doesn't actually use its remainder for anything.
It just bleeds it off.
Right. Then Deacon's second level, the morphodynamic system, the whirlpool in the river.
Right.
Dietz calls this a partial or self-reinforcing closure. The system has generated a pattern, and it uses its boundary to actively maintain that pattern against the chaotic flow of water, but it's blind.
It only works as long as the external energy holds up.
Exactly. And finally, the pinnacle, Deacon's teleodynamic level, the living hunting cell.
Dietz calls this full or self-superseding closure.
And I want to pause here because that word, superseding, is sort of the hinge of the entire paper.
It really is the engine of the whole framework.
Dietz defines a full closure as a system that can basically update its own identity criteria in response to accumulated remainder.
And this is where we take a deep dive into causation.
Uh-huh.
Because this concept of supersession is exactly how Dietz explains the causal power of absence.
Right.
Deacon said absence is causally efficacious. Dietz translates that into remainder drives supersession.
Let's make that really concrete. Like, what does supersession actually look like in practice?
Think about a massive closure regime, like a dominant scientific theory.
Okay.
Let's say Newtonian physics.
Right.
That scientific paradigm establishes strict rules for what counts as the valid observation of gravity and motion. It is a massive cognitive closure regime.
Okay.
But as scientists continue to observe the inexhaustible universe, they inevitably find anomalies.
Things that Newton's equations just cannot predict or explain.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like the strange orbit of Mercury.
So those anomalies are the remainder.
Yes.
They are the specific data points that the closure boundary of Newtonian physics systematically left out.
Yes. And over decades, that remainder accumulates. It literally piles up against the boundary of the theory. It creates immense intellectual and, frankly, thermodynamic pressure. The system is visibly failing to map reality.
So the closure regime faces a brutal choice.
Exactly. It must either update its criteria to absorb the new information, which is supersession, creating a new, wider boundary, like Einstein's theory of relativity, or the old system will just collapse under the pressure of its own inadequacy.
It evolves or it dies.
Evolve or die, exactly.
And this isn't just a metaphor for scientific revolutions. It is literally true for a living cell facing a changing chemical environment.
Absolutely.
If the pH of the water changes, that is remainder, unpredicted data,
right,
the cell must supersede its old metabolic boundaries to process the new reality, or it literally dies.
It's true for a wolf learning a new hunting ground, too.
Oh, yeah.
The remainder, the prey that escaped because the wolf's mental map was wrong, forces the wolf to physically update its internal map.
This relentless pressure from the unmodeled reality is the engine of all evolution and all learning.
It is.
The causal power of the absence is the thermodynamic pressure it exerts on a system, basically forcing it to supersede its current limits.
That is exactly it.
That is just, it's a beautiful way to frame existence.
It's stunning.
The things we don't know, the things that hurt us or surprise us because we didn't see them coming, that remainder is literally the fuel for our own evolution.
It forces us to grow larger just to encompass the absence.
But I want to push this even further.
Okay, let's go.
Because updating a chemical boundary to survive acidic water or updating a scientific paradigm makes perfect logical sense.
Right.
But how does this specific geometry of remainder scale up to me feeling existential longing?
Right, the human element.
Or me reading a poem and feeling moved to tears. How do we get from a self-fighting entropy to a human being searching for profound meaning?
This brings us to the penultimate section of the paper titled From Molecules to Meaning.
Yes.
And it relies entirely on Dietz's concept of deep closure.
Deep closure, right. Mm-hmm. Dietz says that Deakin's intentional phenomena, things like meaning, purpose, thought, those things we defined earlier by what they are about, are what the closure framework calls the products of deep closure.
Yes.
How does depth change the geometry?
As closure regimes nest deeper and deeper inside one another, escalating up the evolutionary ladder, they begin to utilize their remainder in radically different ways.
Let's trace that arc.
Okay, at the base level, you have a teleodynamic living cell.
Right.
It uses its molecular remainder, the specific chemicals it excludes or fiercely requires, to specify its protein functions. Mm. It is entirely chemical and metabolic.
But then evolution forces that system to nest. You zoom out to a whole multicellular organism, like a bird or a dog.
Exactly. That organism has nested billions of those cellular closures inside itself, and it operates at a much higher emergent level, which is a perceptual closure regime.
Okay, so it builds a sensory predictive model of its physical environment.
Yes. And when the environment surprises it, when it encounters perceptual remainder, like a predator it didn't hear coming, or a branch that suddenly breaks under its weight, it uses that physical surprise to rapidly update its internal model of the world.
It learns.
It learns.
And then we take one more massive evolutionary step up.
To us.
To a conscious, language-wielding human being.
At this level of deep closure, we aren't just reacting to chemical gradients or sudden perceptual surprises in the bushes.
Right.
We have developed a cognitive closure regime. We build incredibly complex, highly abstract mental models of reality, of the distant future, of our own pasts, of society, of who we think we are.
So what is the remainder here?
The remainder at this level is the vast, echoing gap between our fragile, finite mental models and the terrifyingly infinite reality of the cosmos.
So at the cognitive level, the remainder is literally the gap between what I expect the world to be and what it actually is.
Yes.
Is the gap between the justice I want to see in the world and the cruelty that actually happens out there. It is the gap between what I know and what is true.
Precisely. And Dietz argues that at this extreme level of deep nested closure, that gap, that structured absence between our model and reality, generates the actual felt subjective experience of meaning, longing, and purpose.
Wow.
You feel a burning sense of purpose precisely because you are cognitively oriented toward a goal that is fundamentally absent from your current reality.
Yeah.
You feel deep, aching longing because your cognitive model is oriented toward a human connection that is currently missing.
So the remainder is no longer just functionally processed as a data update. Really? It is subjectively experienced as pure emotion.
It is the weight of the void physically pressing against your consciousness.
Which brings us right back to the Deakin quote from the very first minute of this deep dive.
Little circle.
Longing, desire, passion, mourning, loss, all are based on an analogous intrinsic incompleteness. The exact same physical geometry that defines the literal hole in the wooden wagon wheel has scaled and evolved over billions of years into the devastating psychology of human desire. That is just staggering.
It is an incredibly unified theory of reality.
It really is.
From the basic laws of thermodynamics governing heat dissipation, all the way up to the philosophy of mind and human emotion, It is one continuous, completely unbroken line of structural logic.
However,
yes.
Despite this incredible, almost flawless alignment between these two major thinkers, Dietz points out one narrow but absolutely critical divergence in the paper.
Right.
They agree on the mechanics of almost everything we've talked about, but they hit a massive brick wall when it comes to the hard problem of consciousness.
Yes, and this is a crucial distinction for anyone interested in the philosophy of mind.
The hard problem is the ultimate hurdle.
Yeah, it really is. It's basically about how we explain the actual feeling of being alive, the phenomenal experience itself.
Right.
Why does processing all this data feel like anything at all from the inside?
Let's break down the two stances, because they are very distinct. The text says that Deakin basically brackets the question of conscious presence.
He does.
What does that actually mean in the context of his thermodynamic work?
To bracket it means he deliberately sets it aside at a separate, perhaps entirely unsolvable issue within his specific framework.
Okay.
Deakin's thermodynamic model flawlessly explains the structure of thought and perception. It explains the physical mechanics of how a brain processes information, how it leverages those essential features to navigate a hostile world.
How things like purpose and meaning functionally emerge as constraints.
Yes.
But he stays entirely neutral on whether there is something it is like to experience it.
Exactly. He doesn't claim to solve why the mechanical processing of remainder actually feels like something from the inside.
Right.
He explains the incredibly intricate, beautiful machinery of the mind, but not necessarily the light inside the room that makes the machinery visible. He just doesn't tackle the bare subjective conscious presence itself.
But Dietz takes a radically different stance with the closure framework. Dietz refuses to bracket it.
Right. Dietz tackles it head on by treating what they call C, bare conscious presence, as a primitive.
A primitive, like a fundamental, irreducible building block of the universe.
Yes.
Like how mass or electric charge or space-time itself are primitives in standard physics.
Exactly like that.
Yeah.
In Dietz's view, conscious presence isn't some magical vapor that just suddenly pops out of a system once it reaches a certain level of complex thermodynamic organization.
It's not a byproduct derived from the machinery.
No, not at all. Instead, bare conscious presence is the foundational underlying condition under which those organizational levels are actually experienced, rather than just mechanically processed in the dark.
So if a teleodynamic system, a deeply nested living human being, possesses this primitive C, then the structural remainder we've been talking about all hour isn't just an unconscious algorithm quietly updating a spreadsheet.
Right.
It is actively felt. The pressure of the inexhaustible world against our finite model actually hurts. It longs. It rejoices.
Yes. And what is really vital to understand here is that Dietz does not view this divergence as a flaw in Deakin's 2011 work at all.
Oh, interesting.
In fact, Dietz explicitly states they are perfectly complementary.
How so?
Well, Deakin provides the ultimate organizational, functional, thermodynamic account of life and mind. He explains exactly how the biological machinery is physically wired to capture and utilize absences.
Okay.
Dietz provides the phenomenal primitive, the C, that actually illuminates that machinery.
So they absolutely need each other to form a complete picture.
They do.
Deakin maps out the intricate physical grammar of the language, and Dietz basically explains the conscious voice that is actually speaking it out loud.
That's a perfect way to synthesize it.
Between the two of them, they explain both the functional evolutionary mechanics of a brain constantly updating its predictive models to survive, and the subjective, devastating reality of a person feeling the sting of a shattered expectation.
When you interlock them like this, you get a framework that doesn't commit the sin of reducing the profound human experience to just cold, dead, bouncing atoms.
Right.
But it also completely refuses to rely on magical, unscientific thinking. It firmly grounds our deepest, most ephemeral subjective realities in the rigid physical structure of the universe.
Okay, we have covered a massive, demanding amount of conceptual ground today.
We really have.
Let's kind of synthesize this as we wrap up. If you look at this the way Dietz and Deakin do, it completely rewrites how you view your own biology and your own mind.
It really changes everything.
What we're looking at here is a profound historical convergence of thought.
It is rare to see this happen so cleanly in academia.
You have a rigorous, empirically driven, thermodynamic theory of evolutionary biology, which is Terence Deacon, and an entirely separate, logically driven structural philosophy of mind and epistemology, which is C.F. Dietz.
Right.
And when these two completely separate disciplines tunnel through the mountain from opposite sides, they independently arrive at the exact same structural truth. That is huge.
It is incredibly strong cross-disciplinary evidence that they are tracking something fundamentally real about the nature of reality.
Yeah.
Both disciplines found that absence is not just an illusion. It's not a trick of language.
Right.
Absence is real. It has specific structure. And it actively, forcefully drives the evolution of life and mind.
It basically forces science to fundamentally rewrite its ontology.
It does.
We can no longer just look at the matter. We can't just count the atoms in the room. We have to look at the constraints, the remainder, the holes in the wheels of reality.
Because, as Dietz powerfully concludes the paper, the grammar of absence is the fundamental grammar of every organized system that exists in the cosmos. And most beautifully, it is the grammar of every conscious being reaching toward what it cannot yet name.
I love that line. It really encapsulates the entire emotional and intellectual journey of this deep dive.
It really does.
And before we go, I want to leave you with a final thought, a provocation, really, to sort of mull over on your own as you go about your week.
A bit of homework.
Exactly. We have spent this time establishing that our deepest, most profound feelings of purpose, longing, desire, and meaning are literally generated by our remainder.
Right.
There are the thermodynamic friction created by the structured absence between our finite, limited minds and this terrifyingly inexhaustible universe. The gap itself is what makes us feel alive.
The gap literally generates the meaning.
Right. So here's a question for you to consider. What would happen if we actually succeeded in closing that gap?
Oh, that's a wild thought.
Right. If a future human superintelligence, augmented by technology, or perhaps a perfectly enlightened spiritual being, somehow achieved a cognitive model of reality with absolutely zero remainder, what then?
What would they even be?
If they managed to know everything perfectly, mapping the universe one-to-one with no structured absence left, would they achieve ultimate transcendent peace?
Or, without that remainder pressing against their boundaries, would the very mechanism of meaning, purpose, and longing simply vanish from their existence entirely? It is a haunting question. It heavily suggests that our imperfections, our blindness, and our constant failures to fully understand the world might actually be the absolute structural prerequisites for our humanity.
It is something to deeply think about the next time you feel a profound sense of loss or a burning desire for something you don't yet have.
That painful feeling isn't a glitch in your programming.
No, it's not. It's the engine. So thank you for joining us on this incredible mind-bending journey today. And remember, the next time you're trying to understand how a complex system works, whether it's the engine in your car, the dynamics of a society, or the longing in your own heart, don't just stare at the spokes. Don't forget to look at the hole in the wheel.